Accession number 29079, reel 4.
Harry Gaines, reel 4. Staying with the jungle for a while, could you talk a bit about moving through the jungle and how you'd actually make progress? Is it what was it like to move through unpathed jungle?
Well, it depended on where you were. If it was fairly flat and there wasn't much bamboo, it was not that bad, because a lot of it was, when we say jungle, it was teak forest. But quite often you came up into thick bamboo areas of thick bamboo, and getting through that was pretty awful. And particularly once the monsoon has started, sometimes the movement was so difficult, if you were on a hill or something like that, that even the mules couldn't carry their loads. And this is where the Africans came into their own, because they were well used to carrying loads on their heads. So sometimes we made progress with the Africans carrying the loads over the difficult bits and letting the mules make their own way.
Did you have to be careful about leaving a trail or not?
Oh, yes, of course. There was a strict drill for making of fires, etc. All that had to be extinguished and no traces left. And if one had been marching along a track, etc., you didn't pile off the track at one particular point. You just all turned and entered on a broad front so that you wouldn't leave that much. Of course, the Japs soon could follow up later. But
and what was the process when you were in the jungle each night?
Well, we bivouacked, and so we in a fairly wide area, and there was always a stand to until it got dark, where everybody was on guard, as it were. And then once we felt we were fairly safe, we left guards on duty, of course, but the rest stood down, and then we were able to make fires, small fires, up to brew up, and sleep, and then stand to again in the morning, and then try and have another brew up before we continued.
You were sleeping in hammocks?
No, we just had one lightweight blanket and one small ground sheet. That was the beginning. We didn't get hammocks until towards the end, when the sickness rate was rising. We were issued, once the monsoon started, everybody was issued with gas capes, which were not being used. So you could get, these were the standard gas cape of oilskin material, and this came in very useful for trying to keep yourself dry.
And was this an official set process, or did you improvise as you went along in terms of establishing a bivouac?
Oh, we improvised as we went along. My African sergeant, who was a huge fellow, he and I soon got clever at building a little bed out of bamboo. So you could sleep on the bamboo about a couple of inches above the ground.
On that first trek from Broadway to Aberdeen, once you reached Aberdeen, what happened?
Well, our job was to it was intended to be a fortress. It was never attacked by the Japanese on the ground, but we had a considerable number of air raids and strafing by Zeros, and this was used, as it were, as a transit fortress. For example, 14 brigades had marched down from the north, from Lado. They'd had a hell of a trip. And then they took part in some operations around Indore, attacking the odd Japs positions, etc. there. And it was used to fly in our two sister battalions that of the brigade. That was 7 NR and 12 NR. And they marched off and took part in the operations at White City, which was so called because of all the parachutes which had been dropped around it. And there was that was another stronghold where there was a lot of fierce fighting. And then there were other columns operating all over the area, to the south and to the east. And casualties were being brought in by light plane and into Aberdeen, treated in the field hospital we had set up, and then flown out by Dakota. So sometimes a chap would be brought in, wounded, possibly, and landed on a Dakota, and within 3 hours was in a field hospital in northern India. That worked pretty well. Not always, of course. The strip was not that long, and there were a number of planes which overshot, so we had about 4 Dakotas piled up at the end of the strip. If that happened, there was always a bit of a rush after getting the crew out or whatever to get hold of the rations on board, because they were super. They were not K rations, they were a different type. One poor plane was going to overshoot, so the pilot turned, and as he turned, his engines cut out and he went crashed into a hill, and only one chap managed to get out of that lot. All the rest were killed or burnt.
How much contact did you have with your superior officers?
Oh, well, I was a platoon commander then, so I had a lot of daily contact with the chap in charge of the mortars and the machine guns, which we'd set up in positions. And then very little, in fact, with the colonel, because it was the captain in charge of us who went to the meetings. But there were a lot of high-level meetings at Aberdeen between the various brigade commanders and the special force commander. But we knew what was going on. We were kept pretty well informed.
What did you feel about Wingate as a commander?
Well, we all adored him. And, of course, he was very strong-headed, and that's the reason he got killed. Because he'd been into, I don't know if it was Aberdeen or Broadway, and his American pilots didn't want to take off and fly back to base in northern Burma, India, because of the weather, but Wingate insisted, and the plane crashed and they got killed. The force lost its character after that. It was a chap called Len Tain took over, and he was not the strong character that Wingate was, and it was then decided that the force should change its character as being a sort of a holding strongholds from which we could sally forth and attack the Japs. It was ordered to march northwards to assist the Americans coming down under General Stillwell, Vinegar Joe, who hated the Brits, and was insisting that we be used as ordinary infantry, so we're losing our character of being mobile columns. On the, we all began to march northwards, and that some, the other columns operating on the far side of the main railway, and our two brigades, three brigade, and 111 brigade, which was British and the Gurkha troops, marching northwards to join up with the advancing Brits and the Americans.
Did you have much contact with those other columns, the British and the Gurkha ones?
Not much, no. We did, in fact, have one particular close contact. The commander of 111 Brigade, John Masters, who wrote lots of books about the war afterwards, decided to set up another stronghold called Blackpool. And this was badly sited. It was all badly provisioned, and they set the stronghold up, and the Japs were able to bring a lot of artillery and heavy machine guns into play. They'd learned a bit themselves, and they really beat this Blackpool up, and so it had to be evacuated with a great loss of troops, and most of them came through our lines. We were due to go into Blackpool, our column, to help it, and we'd come down from the mountain range by the high hills at the side of the valley with the stronghold down below, and we'd normally almost got into Blackpool. Now this was during the monsoon, and in order to get down into the valley bottom, we had to revet miles of the track, the main track, with bamboo having kind of steps. And this proved invaluable, for when those who managed to get out of Blackpool were coming through our lines, our Africans were able to help carry all the wounded and do it fairly easily because of all the revetting that had taken place. We made lots of stretchers out of bamboo, and the Africans had a lot of them head loaded the wounded up over the hills and westwards to a big lake, Indorji Lake, and there the wounded were flown out by flying boat. Now, a lot of them were thanked their lucky stars that they had come through our lines.
What contact did you have with the Japanese?
Well, we had a lot of battles. When we went north from Blackpool again, we got into the valley and had were fighting the Japs around the town of Mogong.
And how did your Nigerians respond to the...
Well, they were getting hardened then, and they were holding their own. I had been evacuated sick during the last, before the last month. That was when the Americans were Merrill's Marauders, and the Chinese were coming down the main valley. Their object was to take the big airstrip of Michinar. We were south of there, pushing up the valley to meet them. And there were columns operating either side of the valley then. So we had a lot of skirmishes with the Japs who were had to retreat, but of course, being the Japs, they never surrendered or anything like that. They just stood their ground until they were killed. So we had a few casualties, some officers killed, a lot of Africans killed.
Could you talk a bit about the tactics and methods of deploying against the Japanese when on jungle patrols?
Well, it depended what you were doing. For example, from Aberdeen we didn't have to do any patrolling, but those other battalions, including the 7th and 12th Nigeria Regiment, they were down in White City, and they were going out on fighting patrols, etc., tackling what Japanese they could come across. There were old Japanese bases, for example, at a rather large village called Indore, and so there was a lot of fighting going on around there. And we're also setting up ambushes. You see, the Japs were moving up and down the main valley on what roads there were, so there was chance to set up ambushes, etc.
How much contact did you have with the Burmese population?
Very little. Very little.
You mentioned buying food.
Oh, that was only when we were on the marching from Blackpool to Aberdeen, and when we were refused a drop, so we had to. And then we deliberately got near a village where we could buy something. How, but that was the only time.
Were you encouraged to stay away at other times?
Well, it was dangerous to get into villages because that disclosed your position, where you were.
How did you pay for that food?
Oh, with rupees.
Had you been given them as an emergency fund? Or
yes, every British officer was given a limited number of rupees.
And what was the morale like in your platoon as time passed?
Oh, it was generally good, but I think towards the end everybody was one at desire, which was when are we going to get out, because we were only supposed to be in for 3 months, and after we were nearly in for 6 months, and We were all dishevelled. We looked like bloody scarecrows without beards and things. In fact, when finally we did meet up with an advancing British troops of the 36th Division who were coming down from the north, these soldiers looked so clean, they couldn't believe that we were in such a terrible state. You can imagine, after months in the wet, in the mud, and with the beards, and looking gaunt and yellow with all the metrogrin. But discipline was still good.
How effective do you feel that the Chindit operations were?
Well, it's hard for me as a junior officer to say, but many accounts after the war played down the part played by the Chindits, but in fact this seemed to be a deliberate policy on the part of the India HQ. They never really approved of Wingate, tended to deride in the official reports made after the war that they hadn't proved effective. But in fact, later on, when we were able to get hold of Japanese records, it then came clear that in fact we had really caused a lot of problems for the Japanese. And it became clear that if we'd held on to our main stronghold of White City, the advance of the British and the Americans down to that point would have been taken 6 months less, because once the monsoon started, the main part of the army just couldn't move. So if they hadn't given up this firm stronghold, I mean, it was terrific. It had a Jocosa strip, a light plain strip. It was heavily defended. And the Japs did break in once, but only once. The rest of the time they failed to get in. And if that had been held, and continued to have been held, then it would have facilitated the advance down into central Burma. So it was a strategic mistake to have give it up, as long-term historical research has proved. But just afterwards, I think there was a feeling amongst particularly the regular Indian Army part of it, that, and even General Slim was only slightly warm in his appreciation of what had been achieved. Well, I have read a report afterwards about the war in the Pacific, and these two American authors were highly sceptical of the whole effort in Burma. They said it didn't play any real part in the winning of the war.
And what's your own opinion?
It's hard to say. I mean, if we just held the line in the northern Burma, particularly after the Japanese failed to break through at Kohima. You know, Kohima was one of the bloodiest battles of the whole area. Perhaps we could have just let Burma, I don't know, left Burma in Japanese hands. And I don't know what damage they could have done. They would have obviously tried to break through into India again. I think we had to go into Burma.
What was your attitude towards the Japanese?
Well, we didn't have much contact. It wasn't until we learnt of what happened to the POWs and what had happened elsewhere with the Japanese that our attitudes really hardened. I mean, I was particularly aghast. By chance, I had left the West African forces and at the end of 45 to go back to British troops, and I had the forty-five. There were still some chaps recovering in Ranchi Hospital who'd had been ex-POWs, and I went to see them, and some of them were from my old battalion, the 1st 5th Sherwood Foresters. When I saw what they had been through, my personal attitude was I'd never be friendly to the Japanese.
Were you able to get any impression of how they regarded you and the Nigerian soldiers in particular?
Oh, later on, from Japanese records, they were really scared of the Africans because they thought the Africans were cannibals.
Had that been an impression you'd tried to cultivate?
Or pardon?
Had that been an impression you tried to cultivate, or was that just misinterpretation on their part?
I couldn't get that question.
Had you been deliberately cultivating that impression of your Africans being cannibals, or had the Japanese just assumed?
No, I think the Japanese had just assumed that.
You returned to India in September 1944?
Yes, back in 44. And after the battalion had recovered, we were sent down into the Madras, near Madras area. And their special force by that time had been disbanded. But we were still regarded as special in some way, and we were then preparing to land in Malaya if we had gone into Malaya, but of course the atom bomb, but that was going to be our task, to be part of the forward troops landing on the Malaya Peninsula, but that wasn't necessary.
Did you have any awareness of the situation in Europe?
Oh, yes. We knew that D-Day, there was no lack of publicity about that. I mean, we were in Burma when the D-Day took place. So we kept informed of events. We felt that too much publicity was being given to what was going on in Europe and not enough what was happening to us, or indeed to other parts of the Pacific War.
And what were your feelings on hearing of Japan's surrender and the ending of the war?
Well, thank God it was. I mean, everybody was very, very pleased. I was then back with another battalion, the 12th Sherwood Foresters. I'd left the West Africans, back with them, and shortly after that, everybody was very pleased. and we didn't know how long we were going to continue in the army, for when we were going to be the big talk was, when are we going to get home? I mean, it was always a good topic of conversation. Shortly after that, I was transferred yet again to the brigade headquarters of this British division, of which the foresters were part. I can't remember the name of the division, but I was in the brigade headquarters, and I stayed there for 4 months, and then March 1946, and then I was, because that division was breaking up, there was no need for it. I was one of the last in the brigade headquarters, and finally that broke up, and I was transferred to the 1st Battalion of the South Staffordshire Regiment. They were in Agra, the home of the Taj Mahal, or as an American once described it to me, a jewel in a shithouse. And I stayed there for another 3 months, and then my DMOB number came up.